It's March 3rd, 2018. This is Last Impressions 46, and I'm Justin Katz asking, isn't this stuff just obvious? In the serendipitous way of these podcasts, the theme that emerged in a lot of the clips that I paused to write down for an itinerary for this podcast had to do with a particular kind of a concept, and that concept this week was that some things just seem kind of obvious, and a lot of them, it seems, increasingly, are things we're not allowed to say or talk about, and which obviously makes it harder for people to see the obvious when nobody else is allowed to talk about it, and we train ourselves not even to think it. So the first clip I want to start with is Rhode Island Center for Freedom and Prosperity CEO Mike Stenhouse. He was on the Rhode Island Public Radio show Political Roundtable, and online they do an additional clip. They call it, I think, Q&A. And there was an exchange that Stenhouse had, not with host Ian Donis, but with, I guess, co-host, regular contributor, whatever his title is, Scott McKay, who is a progressive unionist, former reporter for the Providence Journal. And I thought this exchange was telling. Now, Ian Donis asked Mike Stenhouse why he thinks Democrats seem more concerned about Russia these days. Russia, 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 in a Russia gate, whatever you want to call it. And this was Mike's answer. Now, pay special attention to Scott McKay's follow-up question itself.
I just think it's a means for them to try to take down the president. I do. I think they would latch on to anything if they thought it could harm this president. So I think it's a bit disingenuous. I think it's a bit unpatriotic, if you want me to be honest about it.
How does that differ from what the Democrats did to Obama, this birther? I mean, the Republicans, excuse me.
That was unpatriotic, too.
So now, of course, we should pause before getting into the intellectual stuff and be political. You know, that should come first. So what we need to observe here is that McKay's little slip saying it was the Democrats that did that to Obama, well, that's not quite a slip, because if you'll recall, birtherism was something the Democrats did to Obama. That was the Hillary camp. How directly from Clinton, I don't know. You know, I'm not going to go there. But people within the Hillary camp spread those rumors about Barack Obama's heritage and birth during the primaries. But more to the point, the obvious thing here is the scale. For birtherism, there was no special investigator. There wasn't a year plus of massive media coverage with journalists on networks and multiple cable channels proclaiming the possibility that President Obama was born out of the country. That wasn't the way that went down in the least. I mean, there were some relatively fringe characters who really made a big deal out of it. Oddly enough, one of them was now President Donald Trump. But it wasn't this thing where we had investigations and serious contemplation of the implications of the possibility that Barack Obama was not born an American citizen. I mean, come on. That you can't even compare the two. There's no tit for tat there. And as for the question itself, the initial question, Ian Donis refers back to the 1980s and the harmony of agreement in opposition to Russia and the Soviet Union. But that also ignores multiple things. I mean, first of all, the harmony wasn't quite so huge. I mean, I was still a kid back then, but I remember Reagan was constantly attack. I mean, Ted Kennedy wanted to work with the Russians on his political behalf in opposing Reagan and conservatives. And second, have we forgotten that little on a hot mic incident with President Obama talking to Medvedev, Putin's stooge, for while Putin was out of office, out of the presidency or whatever the office is called there. And President Obama said, "You've got to tell Vladimir that I'll have more flexibility after the election." I mean, we can speculate what he meant by flexibility, but that's not exactly proof of the Democrats' hard line with Russia. Isn't this stuff obvious? Maybe the king on this theme, my bigger theme here, maybe the king of isn't this stuff just obvious in recent weeks, even months, has been Jordan Peterson. He's a Canadian psychology practitioner and professor, I believe, he has a book out called 12 Rules for Life. And he's been a big hit with this book and before the book with YouTube videos, with a sort of back to basic traditionalist prescriptions for people and how to live your life. He was on Econ Talk with Rush Robert. He was on The Remnant with Jonah Goldberg, which I'll be getting to in a little bit. But here he is on Econ Talk with Rush Robert, applying his approach, his back to basics, common sense approach to the politicization of college campuses. To set this up a little bit, Robert asks about Peterson's rule, I guess in a book, about fixing yourself before trying to fix the world. But Robert asked, he personally is starting to worry. I mean, he wants to take that attitude, fix yourself before you fix the world, but he's starting to worry that the entire Western project, our entire civilization, ultimately, is threatened by a lot of what's happening in the culture and out of it and needs support. And Peterson, he starts out by saying that that public conversations are really, realistically, about the biggest thing that people can do. If you're not in a position, a policy-making position, and you can't make large-scale decisions about policy, or I guess at the head of a movie studio or a news channel or somewhere where you can reach a lot of people and your decisions have that kind of effect, about all you can do is one by one with people having conversations and even making those, you know, pushing the conversations back to a traditional idea of what it's possible to say. And Peterson also in this regard expresses a belief that fixing what's around you, if you just concentrate on yourself and on those whom you can influence nearby you, that aggregates into systemic changes we need. So if everybody's behaving in a certain way, that builds upon itself. And so the thing I like about Peterson's response here is that, in effect, this is a paraphrase. He says, you know, well, in concentrating on what's local to you, your family, your community, maybe you're failing to take on the major problems of the day. Maybe you're sitting it out in some sense. But, you know, maybe, and that's just, he uses the phrase, proper humility. You're just admitting what you can affect and what you should try to affect. And here's where he applies this sort of common sense idea in a way that might spark, let's say, objection.
We take 18-year-old kids, we put them in Ivy League universities, and we tell them to criticize the system and to act as political activists. And I look at that and I think, God, you kids, you don't know anything. You don't know anything. You've never had a job. You've never taken care of anyone, including yourself. You can't organize your own household. You've never read anything. You don't know how to write. You don't know how to think. But it's okay. Your professors can tell you that now you're in a position to criticize the foundations of Western civilization. It's like, it's horrifying.
Wow. Are you allowed to say that kind of a thing? What an unacceptable opinion that people with limited life experience who've largely been taken care of their entire lives should have some sort of humility when tearing down the society they've inherited. That's outrageous. How could he even think such a thing? I'm almost positive that show was recorded prior to the Parkland shooting and the celebration of the activist kids that came from that. But it certainly applies in a large way. I mean, even young adults should feel free to speak up, but to celebrate their opinion as if it's got some sort of intellectual heft, that betrays a shortcoming, I think, in not insisting on a level of humility. So another clip I came across wasn't on a podcast. It was on Peterson was doing an interview on, I guess it's Vice News. And now one of the subsets of Peterson fandom is to watch him in interviews, because it often seems that his interviewers, they can't help but put words in his mouth. And, you know, so he'll say something and they'll say, well, then aren't you saying that that we should cobble the streets with children's skulls? Isn't that what you're really saying? And I guess her name is Kathy Newman, a British interviewer, was especially egregious in this way. Peterson was on Vice News being interviewed by a young guy named Jay Kasplan Kang. He's Oriental, Jay Kasplan Kang. And there was some of that. Now, I personally didn't find Kang's interview to be as much of a, as worthy of "you got to see this" standard as other conservatives did. I didn't get the sense at all that Kang was trying to misrepresent Peterson's statements, or that he couldn't even grasp them. But I think the sense I got from it was that he seemed to sort of have a feel for where Peterson's conclusions went, and he didn't really know quite how to process it. And so the clip I've got here was particularly frustrating here, because neither one of them gets to the obvious conclusion. And of course, you know, in the middle of an interview, you don't think of everything. Your audience is much more, it's like watching Jeopardy. You know, if you're sitting at home casually guessing, you come up with the answers more readily than if you're sitting there with the clock ticking and everybody watching and you don't want to look like a fool. But neither of them came to this obvious conclusion. So with that build up, let me say the first voice coming up is Kang, and the one with the heavier Canadian accent, that's Peterson.
We agree. Not we agree. Yeah. You are arguing that makeup is sexualized, high heels are sexualized, yeah, right? When they enter a workplace, the workplace has a higher preponderance of becoming sexualized.
Right? Yes.
How is that? How do we not then take the next step and say that, ergo, if we want to get rid of sexual harassment in the workplace, that your belief is that women should not wear high heels or makeup in the workplace?
Oh, because there's other potential solutions. People could, you could allow for a certain amount of sexual tension and not act on it in a reprehensible manner.
Now, this goes back and forth quite a bit in this interview, so I had some trouble picking the best clip to use. But the question it raises for me is, why is this so hard? I mean, why is this a difficult conversation, as Peterson is arguing? We have difficulty with these conversations, so we don't know what the rules are because we won't talk about it. But why is it so hard? I mean, we understand that makeup is designed to make a person, a woman, attractive. And we also understand that her being attractive and having taken steps to make herself so will increase the likelihood of her attention on a mild end, maybe harassment less mild, and maybe even something worse. But it will increase the likelihood of that. That's not to say it's her fault or that she's asking for it, but it's just obvious that makeup is designed to make women attractive, and women's being attractive will increase the likelihood that men will respond to their being attractive. It's just, it's almost a tautology. And you can't wish it away by labeling men's natural reaction as something like toxic masculinity. I mean, if we, and this was part of their conversation specifically, if we accept that the outcome of freedom with some tension is preferable to, you know, Chairman Mao forbidding or you know, any dystopia in 1984 forbidding makeup and having everybody wear the same gray jumpsuits and all that stuff, if we acknowledge that the freedom is better, then that should inform how we handle, in this case, men's reaction to the attractive women around them. I mean, that doesn't, I'm not saying that men are excused for outrageous behavior because women wear makeup and high heels. But when we assess the situation in any given workplace, we have to acknowledge that, you know, making yourself attractive is not unlike an unwanted advance in the other direction. I mean, if you're a woman seeking to make yourself attractive at work, or more attractive at work, rather, you will potentially make men around you feel uncomfortable. I don't even mean necessarily in any kind of creepy sense that would, but you could make them uncomfortable that you would never, a woman like you would never date a man like them. That might make them uncomfortable, that feeling. And this sort of feeling, and the feeling of, hey, maybe I'll give it a try, it's a natural emotion. And so it's just not good enough to tell men, you know, just deal with it. I mean, that's just, it's not sufficient, any more than it's sufficient or satisfactory to tell women that they can't act on their natural desire to be attractive. So there's a parity here, and you make allowances for them. You know, putting on the makeup and high heels and dressing in a way that makes you attractive, that's not innocent while making a proposition or contributing or participating in some mild flirtation. That if the makeup is innocent, then so is that sort of behavior. Mild, anyway. I mean, it can get out of hand, obviously, but that's not an affront to goodness. It's just a natural reaction. And so isn't it just obvious that we should leave room for this and not overreact and create this atmosphere of fear? Another set of, I guess you could call them truth bombs, I heard this week, came from Ben Carson. You know, Ben Carson ran for president. He's in a housing and urban development now, under President Trump. Ben Carson confidant Armstrong Williams was on the Daily Signal podcast. In case you don't know or don't pick it up, Ben Carson and Armstrong Williams, both of them are black and take a somewhat different approach to that identity than the cultural or mainstream culture tends to expect. Here's an example of what I'm talking about with Armstrong Williams.
I think the greatest sin against our country is we still have these vestiges of segregation and bigotry and poverty. And people are so willingly to use the excuse, the reason why they have not progressed, because of slavery. And I don't think there's any American that is alive today that can ever use slavery as an excuse as to why they have not been able to progress. I think we live in a society today where we will always have the poor and the struggling among us. But anybody who's willing to work hard, have discipline, and my friend Dr. Carson says this often, and I agree with him, being married, not having babies before you're married, and getting a high school and college diploma, 92% of those people never end up in poverty. And it all goes back to morality. It really does. But, you know, we've sort of abandoned morality. We like to call racism and all these things. But what we're dealing with a world that is broken. There's a spiritual illness that's in this country.
Again, it's another thing that's almost shocking to hear in this day and age. And yet, you know, I'd say it's true. I mean, Williams goes on to push the envelope even farther. He says that he holds Black History Month as a tribute to the ideals of America, not to a particular identity group. I mean, isn't that just an amazing thing to say? Who could think such a thing, right? But it does raise another kind of isn't this obvious thing. A country is in part defined, of course, in how its people actually behave. You can't separate France from the French. How they're behaving is an important part of their definition. And human beings make mistakes. And so this goes back in history. So every mistake America has made, slavery, internment, progressivism, they're all part of what makes the United States the United States in a complete sense. But the definition of a country also has to take into account that what the nation aspires to be, the goal that it places in front of its people for them to pursue, for them to work toward. That is part of what defines a country as well. You can be naive and you can go too far dismissing actual behavior in the service of the aspirations, but you can't condemn a nation for missing aspirations. The aspirations have to be considered. And when you try to pass mandates, whether through government or through extreme social pressure, or boycotts or that sort of thing. If you try to mandate that everybody behave perfectly in line with a sort of government-approved ideology, well, then you take away their ability to aspire. And that is a very un-American thing to do, and itself changes the nature of the country in a way that isn't healthy. So another person who seems to have been on all of the podcasts to which I listen in recent weeks is George Mason University professor of economics, Brian Kaplan, who's very libertarian. And he's got a book out in which he argues that we put way too much emphasis on education as an achievement, because the main value that people derive, actually financial value that people derive from education, is that there is signaling. They're signaling membership in a club. They're saying, I did college. I am the kind of person who does college. That's more important, Kaplan argues, in the data that has more effect than preparing people for specific jobs with specific knowledge, or even teaching them generically how to think. That's the main. One of his most noteworthy pieces of evidence is that your college degree statistically is, or your college education statistically is mostly worthless unless you graduate. So if it were all about your education or learning how to think, you would derive a good amount of your economic value, a lot of the increased wages, say, just after each year, your earning potential should go up. But it's graduation that's the thing. It's the document. So not surprisingly, there are folks even on the intellectual right who push back on this idea. Russ Robert did on Econ Talk, and Jonah Goldberg did as well when Kaplan was on his podcast, The Remnant. And when Kaplan was there, Goldberg actually pushed that envelope because he had had the benefit of the Econ Talk podcast as preparation. So he listed a bunch, I don't know if it was all, but a bunch of Kaplan's books. And they all have this recurring theme of sort of dismissing the effect of institutions on people, particularly on kids and young adults. So in this case, education doesn't have that great of an effect, Kaplan argues. Or another book, parents don't have all that great of an effect. And I guess there were other things, reason itself, you know, that kind of thing. And typically, I've found this sort of argument is presented in the service of emphasizing individual genetics, biology, and coming from libertarians like Kaplan, it tends to be proffered as evidence for a sort of extreme individualism that pushes back not only on government coercion, which is an area where libertarians and regular old conservatives agree, but also on any institution that has the purpose of shaping people. Let's say it serves an attitude of just leave me alone. You have no right to talk to me. One, the most extreme version of this I've heard was an attack on you know, do unto others as you would have them to do on you. You know, or no, not that though. I'm sorry. On the being our brother's keepers, and having a responsibility toward each other. That, you know, we don't have a responsibility. I mean, that's the most extreme. And that follows if nothing we do for each other can actually help, well then, you know, you're just limiting me if you try to shape me. And so I think it's that kind of context and experience that leads Jonah Goldberg to object. And he asks, a direct quote, why aren't we still in the trees? If none of these institutions can have an effect, if we're all just radical individuals are born, we're almost predestined at our birth, how can we have evolved into a complex modern society? And here's Kaplan's answer.
Yes. I mean, of course, all these books are based upon comparing different things that can happen within a culture. Right. So, I mean, like, you know, if you ask me what is something that would make a big difference for an individual, I'd say, yeah, move someone from Congo to Britain.
Right. Okay.
Right. So, you know, like, you know, so in like there's great work on this. So if you go and do an international adoption of a kid from an orphanage in a third world country, raise them in Sweden or Britain or the U.S., they do dramatically better in almost every way you can imagine than if they had stayed back at home. So you know, there are environmental changes so vast that they can have a vast effect on the individual. But most of the changes that we focus on aren't like that. So, you know, like for kids. So, you know, if you could be adopted by either a really wealthy family or like a working class family, as long as they're both within the U.S., what the data say is that the adult you turn into is not going to be that different either way. But of course, if you could be either be grow up in the modern U.S. or be sent back in time to the year 1200 in England, well, then there's going to be enormous differences. So, meaning, you know, a way you might think of a lot of this is that we overrate every specific mechanism for change. Even though, of course, yes, when you add them all together, it comes out to something big.
So here's the thing. Dramatic differences in culture develop one parent at a time, one education at a time. You can't say parenting doesn't matter because how each of us parents contributes to how we parent as a group. This is just like Jordan Peterson saying that the aggregate effect of our good conversations changes the direction of our culture. So does the way we parent. Or I'd even say so does the esteem that we hold for education. For education's sake, that fact alone contributes to who we are as a culture and the opportunities that are available and the environment that we create. And, you know, honestly, I can't believe neither Kaplan nor Goldberg highlights this. I mean, Kaplan even goes on to argue that we function in our complex society without people learning broad amounts of information because everybody sort of specializes in what they do know. So I don't have to know ancient Greek philosophy very well as a carpenter, because there's somebody in my society who can take care of the ancient Greek philosophy thing. And the professor doesn't have to know how to, I don't know, build a shed because just to pick the last substantial carpentry I've done, because somebody else is there and they can have that transaction. So he goes on, he gets that when it comes to the economics of not being learning everything, and specializing, but not apparently when it comes to how individually behaving in our own capacity as parents or as people, as advocates, as educators or whatever, contributes to the broader culture. I mean, I mentioned just a few minutes ago the ideals of a country and what we aspire to. And we have also an ideal of parenting. And that's not just some abstraction in the sense that it actually does have an effect on individual people. So Kaplan's whole, I don't want to say shtick, it's not, I don't want to be that dismissive, but his whole point is that each of these individual things doesn't have that great of an effect on an individual. But we have the ideals because even if one family falls short, that ideal is still in the air. The odds that a kid whose parents fail him or her will pick up the important stuff by watching other people's parents or say television or other social institutions, the odds that they'll pick up those ideals are relatively high. And so sure, if your parents fall short, if your education falls short, or you fall short in either context, you'll still pick up a lot of that stuff that you missed out on because of the deficiency. And this, I think, is a great example of how people who attack traditional values undermine our society. I mean, the attitude, and I'm simplifying, of course, here, but the attitude is, you know, we don't need these values. We don't need to uphold the institution of marriage as something purely between men and women who together can create children inadvertently doing what men and women tend to do. We don't need those values. We don't need God. I, the radical individual, see no logical reason why this stone has to be in the wall of our society. So I'm going to remove it. And that's not even adequate. I mean, it's not even, I'm going to remove this from our society. It's, I mean, no, wait, that's the key point is I'm going to remove this from society. Not just, I'm not going to follow this tradition myself because I don't see the logical need. It's, I'm not going to follow it. And I think nobody else should have a right to criticize me for that or try to get me to change my ways or to try to persuade other people that I'm doing something wrong. So we need to take this stone out of the wall of our heritage so that nobody can enforce it as truth, because I don't see the logical purpose to it. And, you know, I've written this and probably said it many times in the past, but sometimes you get the sense that we're running on the fumes of our heritage. I mean, you hear about, increasingly you hear the Chesterton idea of if you come across a gate in the middle of nowhere, do not remove it unless you can explain why it's there. The reason this has such purchase, this metaphor these days, is that that's kind of the project of progressive society, to just knock down the gates because it's in my way right now and I'm not really sure what it's for. Well, this is what it's for. It's for all the kind of intangibles that you can't test for. That was one thing Kaplan repeatedly, whenever Rush Robert or Jonah Goldberg would say, you know, I just feel like there's an advantage to being able to think or to having had experience with subject matter, even if you forget it. And Kaplan keeps going back to, well, you know, I could invent a test for that. So clearly, we would know, because you these aren't intangibles. You can invent a test that to find out whether students are picking up on a particular topic. And Kaplan says every time we come up with these tests, we find out they're not really picking it up. But you can't, you in that sense, you can't create a test to tell whether a student or a child who had problematic parents or better or good parents, you can't create a test for them outside of their broader society. And Actually, no, that's wrong, because Kaplan admits that you can create that test, and that if you bring somebody from one vastly different society to another, that'll have an effect. So we know it does. And knocking down all of those pillars of, even if they're kind of look like tiny decorative pillars at the bottom of our wall, knocking them down one by one sets us up for a real big fall. And, you know, as I started out by asking, isn't this stuff just obvious? But also what's obvious is that you should go to iTunes, find this podcast, and give it a 5-star review. Or if you're a member on ricochet.com, go there and like this post and all of the other ones, because if they get to a certain number of likes, then people actually have to pay attention to them. And just as important from my perspective, go to the comments to the post on oceanstatecurrent.com, where this podcast appears. Go to my Twitter stream, Justin Katz RI, or Facebook, just search for Justin Katz on Facebook, or wherever else you can comment. Give me feedback. I'm always happy to hear from everybody. And also remember that you shouldn't be too concerned about your first impressions, because you can work those out. It's the last impressions that you have to worry about, because they can stick with you for an eternity. God bless.